start of 15. Doesn't seem very good this year anymore. Okay, it is. Let me just go ahead and start. I don't think everybody's here yet, but it's an introductory class, so I don't know if that puts people away or not. Anyway, let me just skip two slides first and go to tell you who I am. I'm Mancus Fanabrail. I'm a PhD student. I work for Rao Kamapati, who is actually teaching the course, but is out of town. He's in DC and will be back on Thursday. There are some other PhD students. There is one here also in the class. So it's Jay Benton. There is another one, Will Cushing. Us three will potentially give some sort of teaching assistantship aid, but don't expect too much. But if you have any questions and Rao is not around, feel free to drop by the lab. There is another person who's not here as well. He's also in Washington, D.C., and that is Sung-Wook Yoon. He may actually give a few of the lectures in this class that are related to the learning part. And if I skip back, okay. So the course is about planning and learning. However, Rao is mostly a planning person, so there's a heavy stress on the planning part. And as Rao said, probably also in his emails already, almost everything will be available on the webpage. The webpage is given right there. It's rakapashi.eas.ehu.edu/CSE574. Basically, notes will be up there. Links to papers that will be read will be up there. Even the slides of today and also upcoming slides will be posted here as well. Okay, then let me go ahead. A few things. Grading criteria for the course. It's a graduate level course, and the evaluation, although this is subject to change, it's even different from what is up on the website. The website has actually different percentages. But for now, just follow the percentages that are available here on the web, on this slide. 20% for participation, which includes being active in the readings, attend the classes, but most importantly, also attend in the scribes. And I'll explain a bit more about that in a minute. 35% on projects and homeworks, which will come in later in the week or next week. And a semester project for 20% and the midterm and a final for 25%. For the people that just came in, if you haven't got by any chance a piece of paper, there is a survey form, I hope, on each of the tables. Please fill them out and give them back either to me or to Jay at the end of the class. I wanted to talk a little bit about the scribe. Because actually, I need a volunteer for today. Everybody in the class is expected to do a summary of sort of the lecture of one class, and probably people have to do about two, maybe three scribes over the whole period of the semester. And basically, what this entails is just write a little bit of summary. It could be bullet points, but a bit of a description that people can later retrieve. Hey, what was that class about? Oh, okay. And just quickly go over it. You can use it in addition to the slides as well. I'll just show you where it is. Actually, the link for this is also available on the website. If you go to the website itself, there is a link to class wiki. If you press that, internet. Yes. Goes. You get to the class wiki page, and people are expected to write a summary for every class. And the scribes, you just press on that one, and here you can write your scribe. And basically, you press edit. And okay, you need to be logged in. That's another reason to fill out the survey as well. We need your ASU Write ID. And with that, we can add you so that you can actually edit the scribes. Just to go, before I go any further, I need one volunteer for today to do the scribes. See there? Okay. Kartik will do today's scribe. Probably on Thursday there will be another scriber, and it'll follow on, and potentially people can even sign up ahead to do the scribes. Okay. Okay, some prerequisites. These are also noted on the survey form. Basically, it's CSE 471, and I think most of you have taken that class, and actually most of you have taken it under Rao as well. Basically, there's a bunch of things about search, A-star search, you're sort of expected to know, reachability heuristics, CSP and SET, how to sort of formalize them, but also what are sort of the standard solving techniques for those. You're even expected to know a little bit about planning itself. Not too much, but just a background on planning graph, progression, regression. But these things will also come back in the course itself. Also, a bit about logics and probabilistic reasoning. But all these things will also come back during the class here as well. There is actually a textbook for the class. It'll be used sort of 50-50. Probably most of the lectures will come from papers itself, research papers. But this is certainly a very good background reading to follow the lectures. If it's not available in the bookstores, you can get it from Amazon pretty quickly. But I think Rao mentioned it's now available. It's there, I think. So. Yeah. If you can't find it there, go ahead and just order it from Amazon. Although it's not a required textbook, it is useful. Some caveats. The presentations from Rao will not directly follow the book. It'll just use parts of it, but mainly just jump ahead and also mainly talk about what is currently active in the field. And sometimes go back to the principles. So as again, every so often, Rao will assign a sort of a critical key paper, which can either be a paper that is in planning and will actually talk about a specific topic, but it could also be a paper outside of planning, but it will be very helpful to sort of understand how that can be used inside a planning class or in a planning paper. Rao's teaching methodology is basically, tries to be a very true graduate course. Basically, participate, read before you come to class, and I think it has a little bit of a joke there. If he sees too many sleepy faces, he may actually require you to write a little summary about the paper, the critical key paper, before you come to class. So as long as you're up and awake, then I don't think that may be entered. The main thing here is I will assume that you're interested in not just figuring out what has been done, but also where currently most of the action is. What is currently state of the art? Can we, after this course, actually maybe come up with your own ideas and maybe even write your own term paper on an actual planning topic? So, expectations of the class. What Rao expects is sort of at least a time commitment from you, and an active participation in the reading, the attending, in the wiki scribes, and potentially also in online discussions. There may be emails also coming up. What you can expect after this course to have a solid background on automated planning, but also have the ability to read the latest papers that are currently coming out in planning, and ultimately be able to write your own paper on a planet topic. A little bit of background about the people here in the class. There are 17 students currently registered, 10 of which are PhD students. 11 of them have taken 471 with Rao and got an A or higher. 6 of them got an A plus even. Basically, Rao has to try to find a way how to make this class a bit more challenging. The big picture, and this is a bit of where it all starts. To give you a very brief background about planning, I mean, what is really planning? Planning to me consists of three ingredients, and I'll just use the board, I guess. And I'll use a very simple example. I don't know if you're familiar with the shuffle game or shuffle puzzle. You have a bunch of tiles, and in these tiles there are numbers. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and there's a blank tile. And the aim of the game is to sort of get this rearranged and maybe you want to have all the numbers in order. So you have an initial state, you have a goal, and you have actions that you can apply that will actually alter the state. For example, you can move a particular tile so that suddenly the blank position will appear up there and those other things will remain the same. And it's only two will now appear there and the rest will go there. So there's really those three are the ingredients that you have. An initial state, a beginning situation, a goal, and actions that you can apply that will alter the state. And the goal of planning is to find a sequence of actions that will allow you to transform this initial state eventually to the goal. And so what it says here, planning involves action selection. Which actions should you choose in order to get to reach the goal? Also, it's also part of action sequencing. It's not only action selection, you also have to order these actions to make a complete plan. Typically, this ordering also falls under scheduling, where really you have to order or schedule a bunch of jobs or a bunch of tasks. And depending on the problem itself, a plan could either be a sequence of actions, but a plan could also be a policy. If you think of an NDP, a plan could be just if you're in this state, you have to apply that action. If you're in that state, you have to apply this action. In that sense, it could be more of a policy instead of a sequence of actions. There's a few bit of terminology that's probably useful to keep in the back of your mind. There's all these different types of planning. There's domain-independent planning, domain-dependent or domain-specific planning, and domain-customized planning. Domain-independent planning is really, you only have a description of these three ingredients. You don't actually know that you're solving a puzzle game. You may be solving a completely other problem. Domain-specific planners make use of additional knowledge. And a domain-specific planner could fall in either two categories. You can have a standalone program that all it does, it solves this eight puzzle and nothing else. Or you could have a domain-independent planner, just a planner, but on top of that, you customize it so that it will particularly do well in solving the eight puzzle game. There may be something in the heuristic that you may want to maybe useful to add in. If you have a domain independent planner, I mean this customization can come in many ways. It could depend on a heuristic. But if you're solving like something like a CSP, it could also be the variable selection or variable spot. I mean, it can come in different ways, like declarative control rules, procedural directives, or really search choices to try in what things in what order. This is sort of a very basic picture of what planning is. Really, you have an agent which is acting in an environment. And sort of the million-dollar question is, what action should you do next? And a planning problem can come in different shapes and complexities. For example, actions can be deterministic, but they can also be stochastic. An action, let me just go here, I have here, an action can be deterministic. Basically, if you apply an action, you know its outcome, but you may, for example, have a slippy finger, and if I have a slippy finger, then even though I try to move that tile, I may end up coming back in the same state just because I have a slippy finger. Or if I'm a little bit clumsy and I try to do that, I actually accidentally, in some cases, move both of those pieces. So sometimes an action has a known outcome, it's deterministic, or it has a probabilistic outcome. You have multiple outcomes with a certain probability. Actions can be instantaneous or they can be durative. They can occur over a certain time period. Then the environment can come in different shapes as well. The environment can be fully observable to the agent, or it can only be partially observable. For example, all I can see is maybe these top six tiles and the lowest three tiles, I don't know what they are. After maybe moving around, I can reveal what is under there, but it could be just partially observable, the environment. Furthermore, the environment could be static versus dynamic. And static really is that if the agent doesn't act in the environment doesn't change. Otherwise, it is dynamic. The environment can have discrete variables, but it can also have continuous variables. Maybe the agent is acting on a battery, and a battery has some sort of power, which could be a continuous, or follow some sort of continuous function. And then the perception is either perfect by the planner or the agent, or imperfect. Basically, when the agent is trying to sense things, maybe all of this is covered, but it has a potential way to open this door and see what's actually below there, so it can actually sense, left in the left corner is number 7. So really, you can sort of see this flow diagram here, where the agent sort of thinks, then sort of acts, and then potentially, if the environment is not deterministic, may want to sense, and then go back to think, act, and sense. And just before I go any further, I mean, it's maybe very simple out of here, but I just want to ask you guys, what do you think is more difficult? Is deterministic harder than stochastic or not? I mean, what do you think? What is more difficult?
Stochastic
more difficult? Yeah, sure. If you have multiple outcomes, that may think will make things harder. Instantaneous versus durative. What do you think is harder?
Durative,
sure, yeah. Durative actions, because then there's many ways where some action could start. And instantaneous, I mean, things will occur immediately. Observable versus partially observable. Partially observable is harder, yeah, sure. And obviously, these things go on. Dynamic is harder than static. Continuous is harder than discrete. And imperfect is harder than perfect. Really, when you take the easy elements, if you take all the easy elements, you end up with what we call classical planning. Classical planning has an environment that is static, that is observable, and where actions are deterministic and instantaneous. And if you sort of, I mean, these are sort of assumptions for your planning domain. And if you start relaxing some of these assumptions, you get into different types of planning problems. For example, if you were to relax the instant, if you were to add, let's say, durations, you get more into what is called temporal planning. Not only do you have to reason about sequencing, you also have temporal reasoning as well. If you were to relax, let's say, I have to go to this one, propositional. Basically, propositional means, in this sense, that things are discrete. You model the environment in true-false variables, or you model the environment in some other discrete variables. If you relax that assumption and you allow there to be numerical state variables, or basically continuous variables, then you have this whole extra thing where you have to reason about potentially infinitely many states. If you have continuous variables, you allow many, many extra states. Obviously, you can combine the two. What happens if you have durative actions and continuous or numerical state variables? Well, then you get into the area of what is sort of called metric temporal planning. It's temporal, but there's also metric, which relates to these numerical state variables or the continuous state variables. Static. You can relax to become a dynamic environment. Deterministic becomes a stochastic environment. And with that, you can also think of if you have actions that have possible outcomes, not certain outcomes, but probabilities on the effects, then you may want to think of contingent or conditional planning. Can you find a plan that will satisfy the goal with a certain probability threshold? Will it achieve the goal 90% of the time? Another thing is you can relax the assumption of observability and make the environment only partially observable. And in that sense, before I go to this one, I want to actually talk about stochastic. If you have stochastic, oftentimes a stochastic planning problem almost is very similar to an NDP. In NDP, you have states, you have actions, and you have potentially rewards on states. So a stochastic environment is often comes very close to what we know as NDPs. If you add durative actions, then sort of your plan becomes sort of a semi-NDP policy. If we relax the assumption of observability and get partially observable environment, sometimes there you want to look for what is called conformant plan. And in a conformant plan, really what you have is no matter what the initial state is, you still want to achieve the goal. And maybe a simple example is there's a robot that lives in a grid. It wants to go to the goal location, but it doesn't know where it is initially. It could be anywhere in the grid. And still, you want to end up in that position. Basically, what you could do then is your initial state doesn't exist of a single state, but it consists of a set of believed states. I could be in any of these states in the beginning. And really what you want to do then is sort of minimize or reduce your belief state until you're certain that you're, let's say, in the corner, and then you can easily move to your target. So in a conformant plan, no matter what the initial state is, you want to achieve you want to achieve the goal. Okay, so what is sort of state of the art? And maybe to talk a little bit about I mean, planning is dates back to the beginning of the field of AI, to the sort of the late 1950s. Recently, and especially I would say the last 10/15 years, it's become actually a very active field. And people like me and other people that work for RAU often publish papers in these type of journals and conferences. This was formerly known as the American Association for Artificial Intelligence. They have hosted a conference annually, the International Joint Conference on Artificial Intelligence, Artificial Intelligence Journal, Journal of Artificial Intelligence Research, and now there's also one conference typically and only devoted to automated planning and scheduling. And another thing that actually has helped to improve the state of the art of the state of the field is the planning community hosts these planning competitions. It's a biannual competition where people all over the world will enter their planner that they are working on and basically compete against other planners and see who's at that time the best planner around. Currently, although I think it may be a bit dated, but currently the hot areas in planning are what I would say, and actually I think I missed that. Let me just go back. This picture, I forgot one thing here, and that is the agent has goals, and it can either fully satisfy all the goals, or if there are so many goals, it may actually have to select a subset of the goals. So in that case, it can only partially satisfy all the goals that are around. So that's one of the hot topics, but also, I'm going one too far. To apply insights from deterministic planning to, when you relax all these assumptions. Topics that will be covered later in the class are all these, different versions of planning, classical, temporal, metric temporal, non-deterministic, partially observable. But also plan management and state estimation and plan recognition. And here's a nice part. I mean, you want to estimate the current state of an agent given a sequence of actions and observations. So all you're given is a sequence of observations. You're not given the initial state. You're not given the goal. Can you still detect, maybe, what would be the goal if this agent that was following these actions, or in what state would I be if an agent has taken these actions? Can I infer a complete picture of that, or maybe only a partial picture of that? And other topics that will be covered is also applications of planning to workflows, web services, ubiquitous computing, and other applications as well. To have a bit of more of a detailed list, and I think this list is also available on the website. I won't go over it completely, but a bunch of topics that will be covered. And I think if you have a topic that you don't see on here and that you really like to have covered, then I guess just send an email to Rao and he may accommodate it. Compared to last offering, this was the last offering schedule. Basically, what is different is that the first part is condensed into only a few weeks, and the latter part will be, he wants to add more topics, different topics to what was given last time. So, different applications, and I guess I'll just highlight one particular one, which is maybe, One of the nice model applications for planning, and that's the remote agent experiment that was done by NASA. Basically, they had software, or a planning and scheduling based software, maneuver a spacecraft for a certain while without manual or human intervention. If you're interested to read about that, there's a whole chapter of that particular experiment in the book itself. But there's also other applications, workflow management, the Hubble Space Telescope, is actually using planning and scheduling technology to schedule which images it needs to take. And yeah, there's even a bigger list, applications in web services, and applications in workflow management and ubiquitous computing. It's another little bit of a sort of a background slide. Who's interested in planning? To give you a little bit of background of the students that have graduated under Rao, people are now at Xerox PARC in Palo Alto, ISI, or the University of Southern California, the Information Science Institute, SRI, Stanford Research Institute, the Robotics Institute at Carnegie Mellon, and a research lab in IBM India. But there's several other places, including NASA, Honeywell, Lockheed Martin, BBN, General Dynamics, MBARI, which stands for the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute. They have these underwater vehicles and these torpedoes that actually use also planning and scheduling technology to maneuver these robots. And Google, although many of the planning folks that have gone there have sort of disappeared from planning conferences, so they may have, they're either doing planning in secret and they're not allowed to publish it, or they've turned into search people. Okay, so let's get back to planning again, and really about modeling planning. How to model a planning problem. Really, we only have seen what is it made of, but how can we actually model planning? How can we model actions? How can we model states and verify that a plan is actually correct? And really, or conceptually, planning can be seen as a transition system. And we can think of this agent environment dynamics in terms of a transition system, which consists of a set of states and a set of actions. And this is sort of what I also drawn here, this move. A set of states and a set of actions, and each action is sort of maps one state into another state. If you apply an action, you move from one state to another state. And as you can see, a transition system itself can be seen as a graph. And it's almost obvious from here, where the states itself are nodes, and the actions form edges in this graph. Or the transitions are edges in this graph. And to go back a little bit, if transitions are not deterministic, then these transitions form hyper edges. Huh? If I have a slippy finger, then potentially there's a 0.9 chance I'll end up there, and a 0.1 chance that my finger slipped. The agent may know its initial state, but the initial state could also be a subset of all the states. Huh? If you don't see this, then my initial state is definitely this, but I don't know if for example, any of these, etc., those are all potential initial states if I did not see those three tiles. The initial state could also be a set of belief states. It's not a single state, but it's a set of states. And you believe that you're in one of them. Same with the goal. Here,
I drew the goal as a single state, but my goal could easily have been, all I want is, I want tile 1 in the left upper corner, and I don't care about any of the other tiles. That could be a goal as well. And obviously, this particular goal will correspond to many, many states. There are several states in which tile 1 is actually in this corner. So
neither the initial state nor the goal has to be a single state. But oftentimes, and especially in classical planning, the initial state will correspond to one single state. And if you see planning as this sort of transition system, then really what it boils down to is finding a shortest path in this graph. A plan corresponds to a shortest path from I to one of the states that is in G. So really, you're doing a shortest path finding problem. Let me see. Okay. To give you another, a little bit of a feel about transition models. A transition system is a tuple, as I said, of states and actions. And really, a transition itself is a subset of state to state. And here you see not a complete transition graph of the full state, but this is a transition graph for a single action. If you were to apply this action in state A, you end up in state B. If you were to apply this action in state E, you also end up in state B. And you can actually model that or write that down in an incidence matrix. States by states, if you were to apply this action in any of these states, then these are your outcomes. And it's easy to sort of verify that an action or a transition is deterministic if for every state there is only one possible outcome state. And an action is non-deterministic if you have potentially several outcome states, and they may come with probabilities. Let me move on further. If you represent actions in terms of these incidence matrices, this is an incident matrix for one particular action, and this is an incidence matrix for another particular action, then the product of these matrices is really the creates the outcome if you were to apply these actions in sequence. If I apply this action in state B, I end up in F. If I apply this action in F, I end up in D. If I apply this action and then this action, starting from B, I end up in D. What was done if I were to just do them sequentially. And this is really, if you do the product, you get the outcome if you were to do these actions in sequence. Another thing is that from these incidence matrices, you can actually create the full transition graph, basically by summing up. If you sum the transition diagram for this one and transition diagram for the other action, and you sum them up for all the other actions, you get a complete transition graph that represents this whole state change graph, all the potential action and all the states and all the potential transitions that you can make from those states. And really, when you look at let me go one back. When you look at these incidence matrices. And we mentioned this at the beginning. Once these actions are non-deterministic, and there are potentially several outcomes when you apply an action. And if those outcomes have certain probabilities, or if you were to apply this action in state A, there may be 0.9 probability that you end up in B and a 0.1 probability that you end up in E. This is often where we get to MVPs. Get to the next slide. When you think of planning in the context of MVPs, you're looking for a policy. Instead of a sequence of actions, you're looking for a mapping from states to actions. If you're in this state, what action do I have to apply? This will come back also later in the course MVPs will be discussed later this semester. Obviously, you don't want to represent a planning problem in terms of these incidence matrices. Why not? Obviously, if you just look at this 8 puzzle game itself, the number of states here is, the first tile is 9, then the second tile is 8, so it's 9 factorial possibilities, close to 400,000, I think, or 300,000. So there are between 300 and 400,000 potential states. And if you have an incidence matrix, and you want to sort of model your action in terms of an indices matrices, then you need to have an awfully large matrix, because for every row, for every column, you have a state-to-state mapping. And obviously, this is only a very small problem. If you have a 15 puzzle, then you have 16 factorial. And I think I calculated that goes over a trillion states. So obviously, in that case, you want to fall back on some sort of other way to represent states and represent actions. So here, if you explicitly use a transition graph to represent this a transition system, these things just blow up very quickly. So really what you want to do is provide a more compact representation for planning. And really, what is a compact way for representing this transition system? And really, what you want to look at is try to, look at how is the state being defined, and really we can look at states as being specified in terms of state variables or in true-false variables. I'll show an example on the next slide. Same for actions. We don't want to use these incident matrices, but rather maybe work as functions specified directly in terms of these variables. And maybe an example will help. This is a very simple example. It's a rocket domain. The aim here is you have a bunch of boxes, A and B. You have a rocket. The boxes you can load in the rocket. The rocket can fly to the moon, and there you can unload those boxes, and that's sort of the whole move the boxes to the moon. And instead of representing this particular model explicitly in terms of states, you can just look at the objects in this model and see, well, a block could be at Earth or it could be at Moon. And these are just basically true-false variables or true-false propositions. And currently, the current state, as it's represented here, we have block A. Block A at the Earth, block B at the Earth, and the rocket also at Earth. And the goal is also specified in terms of these state variables, and the goal is to have
both block A and B at the moon, and I don't want to have them in my in the rocket. I don't want to have block A nor block B in the rocket.
And obviously here, we're not talking about complete states, but we're talking about little aspects of this of the states. For example, going back to this one again, I could have modeled this one in sort of that perspective by saying tile 7 is in position, let's say, A. And in this case, that is true. But I mean, I would have to introduce several of these because tile 7 could potentially be at location, this location, this location, etc., etc.
What we show here is also how can you then also represent these actions? Can you represent these actions also in terms of these propositional state variables? And yes, we actually can. If you just look at a single action, and now we'll just look at a load action, the load action has certain conditions. It requires that the object that you want to load is at a particular location. In particular, it is at the same location where the rocket is. So if both the object and the rocket are at location 1, then after applying the load action, the object will be in the rocket. When you fly the rocket, basically fly requires that the rocket is at the Earth, and after flying, the rocket is at the moon. It is not at the Earth anymore. And for all objects that were in the rocket, they are now not at the Earth, but are now at the moon. Then obviously the load action, the unload action has a similar thing. You unload an object, the object basically is not in the rocket anymore. I mean, after you apply it. It requires that it's in the rocket, and the object will be out of the rocket. Here, actually, you can see that the effects can be, quite an interesting function, right? Here, for all x that are in, they become at the moon, and they're not at the Earth anymore. And this will come back also. This syntax really follows the action description language, a language that was introduced, I think, in the 70s, I think.
No,
80s. Okay, a little later. Okay, another example. And this is probably one of the most classic examples in planning, a block swirl example. And really what you have here is a table, a bunch of blocks, let's say each with an ID. And really, one more thing. And a gripper that can pick up a block and move it around. And basically what you have is the gripper can pick up a block, it can stack a block, or put it down back on the table, or it can unstack a block from another block. So a pickup and an unstack are slightly different. A pickup really means it's picking up from the table, and an unstack means it's unstacking it from another block. Here you can also use these propositional state variables. Here in this case, there are two blocks, both are on the table, both have nothing on top of them, they're clear, and the gripper or the hand is empty. And apparently the goal is to have the gripper empty, and you don't want block B to be clear. Basically you want A on top of B. So again, all the state variables are there. Depending on the number of blocks, you'll have additional because these fill in these X's. So really what you have as an initial state is a complete specification of truth, false values to these state variables. And the goal state may only be a partial specification of state variables. For example, nothing is said about block A here. Actions, again, also in terms of preconditions over these variables and effects, either adding certain propositions or deleting them. So why are these representations more compact than these blunt representations like these complete state space graphs? Obviously, if you have these incident matrices, as we mentioned, if you have 1,024 potential states, then for every action, you would have to store a matrix that's 1,024 by 1,024. However, this could only be made up of 10 truth false variables, or 10 of these propositional state variables. And so then for every truth false state variable, I mean, there you have a variable and it can either be true or false. So the requirements are obviously much less than if you have to store these big, huge matrices. Same also for the actions. I mean, the preconditions and effects are all now defined in terms of these, only these 10 variables. Some other tricky things. There's also another specification. It's Stripp's assumption. It's another described the action description language. Stripp's is very similar, but it's simpler. And really, in a Stripp's representations, actions must specify all the state variables whose values they change. And in a Stripp's assumption, you cannot have disjunctive effects. If you were to have those in your planning problem, and really maybe I should say, what are these disjunctive or conditional effects? For example, a conditional effect would be if you were to apply action A and apparently variable B is true, then action A will give you R. If, however, Q is true, then action A will also give you W. So this is sort of a condition. Huh? I mean, if only P is true, then it will just give R. If P and Q are true, then action A will give R and W. And obviously, if only Q is true, then it will only give W. But these conditional effects are really not disjunctive and can actually be grounded away or grounded out. And instead of, if you have this representation, you can make it into a Stripp's representation by simply iterating through all the potential possibilities. If these are true, then the effects will be those. If just that is true, and not that, then the effects will be those. If only Q is true, then the effect is that, and if none of these are true, then the action really doesn't do anything. One drawback with this is that if you convert these conditional effects into what we say as a canonical form, you potentially have to introduce many, many more actions just to make sure that you can represent this into individual actions. sort of the pros and cons of compiling down into a canonical action representation. As mentioned, ADL it is possible to compile these actions down into a canonical representation. However, if they are compiled down, they often turn into multiple, potentially exponentially many, sub-actions or actions without conditional effects. Also, if you compile these things down, you're not always really, it's not always useful. Obviously, you have to deal with these many, many copies of those actions, and there may actually be easy ways to deal with the non-canonical approach or these disjunctions. It looks a bit like a trade-off between the I wasn't sure. I mean, maybe the what does it stand for? RSRI.
Reduced instruction set and complex. That should be a C.
Complex instruction sets. But also this will come back later later in the class, and Rao will talk about that. I guess there's one more thing to discuss, and that is, what I showed was only really true-false propositional variables, or true-false state variables. If you want to represent the domain, your variables don't necessarily have to be true or false. They can also have a discrete or finite domain of values. And let's go back once more to this example. I can either represent these things as specifically what is at a particular location. Well, tile 7 could be at any of the 9 positions. But I could also model this particular 8 puzzle as by using multivalued state variables. These are all binary or Boolean state variables. They all have a value of true or false. But I could easily model this as saying, well, the value of cell 1 is either 1, 2, up to 8, or the blank one. And now I have a variable with a finite or discrete and finite domain that's not just true, false, or Boolean, but it has it's a multi-valued state variable. And if I introduce such variables for each and every cell, I have an equivalent representation for this particular example. And often these multi-valued fluent representations are also referred to as vectored representations. And some planners will only work with Boolean representations. Some planners will only work with multi-valued representations. And I guess sometimes there's trade-offs also. Obviously, if you have a representation given like in a multivalued way, you can always translate it back into one in a Boolean way. Really, you separate out all these values, and basically from here you create these values, because in cell 1 you have 7 or any of the other values, which becomes a true-false variable. So if you have a multivalued representation, it is possible to create a Boolean representation by really, for every value in the domain, you create a true-false variable. Obviously, you have a little bit of additional information, because if you have a multivalued representation, you specifically know that
only one of these values can be true at any point in time. And if you have a representation like this, that information you have to sort of find out yourself. How do you know that at location one, I can only have one particular tile? That type of information you would have to find out yourself, which is hard. Going from here to there is easy, but going from a representation from here to there is much, much more trickier. And really, I think it even mentioned here at the very bottom, you would have to find cliques in these Boolean variables. Probably Rao may even check a little bit about that. I think this is the last slide.
Since we have more time, if I can add on this, it's actually trivial. You can convert from this Boolean representation to multivalued in a very trivial way too, which is just by looking at true-false as a multivalued sort of representation. So you can look at true-false as just two values you can take on one particular value. So but there's better ways to do it, which is what.
So I guess maybe last words, make sure you fill out the survey form and leave it here, hand it back. And sort of the things you can expect from Thursday onwards, because from then on it's only Rao will teach with potentially Sungwook. Going through the book and also going through some state-of-the-art or recent research papers, get a solid background about automated planning, but also get a feel of what is currently going on in the field. And with that, I'll wrap it up. I don't know.